Hi, everybody. I hope you are great. I just want to say, one, thanks for getting on board. Thanks for supporting this podcast as much as you can. If you think it's worth listening to, share it with friends. I want to grow this into something significant because I want to keep doing good work and talking with good people and sharing good ideas and good messages because I want to create a little bit of a ripple effect around the world in the tiny little pond that is Craig Harper, and hopefully you can help me do that. If you think what I'm doing and what we're doing is of value or service to others, and you can get on board that train, then I would love your support and I'd love you to do that. I also want to thank Max's, who is, of course, my sponsor for this show, Max's and Maxine's, Australia's leading brand of sports nutrition for guys, and Maxine's, of course, for girls. They're Australian-owned, Australian-made. They've been around for about 3 decades, and I use them all the time. I know people say that when they do sponsorship stuff, but I actually do. I use Max's stuff every day, and I find them to be amazing. Of course, I eat normal food and healthy food, but I supplement with protein powder. I have a few bars. I have a few cookies. I have a few drinks, and they are a big part of what I do and how I stay in shape. So now, if you want to get on board the Max's train or the Maxine's train, go to www.maxes.com or www.maxinesburn.com. Best supplements in Australia, I think. High quality ingredients, create great results, help me stay where I'm going, go where I'm going, help me stay in shape, and they can become part of your regime as well. So thanks, Maxes. Thanks, Maxines. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
How are you feeling?
Good, thank you.
How's your blood pressure?
It's great, thanks.
You're full of shit. She's been a little bit below the weather today, but you're soldiering on, aren't you?
I'm good.
You know what? You need a little bit of junk food.
Oh, do I? Okay.
Maybe some crisps, a beer.
Is that a prescription, is it?
Some pork crackling.
Ew. Says Dr. Craig.
I've never had pork crackling in my life.
You're fucking missing out. You're missing out. I'll give you a script. Paul Taylor, thanks for coming in again, champion.
An absolute pleasure.
How was the feedback after the last? Did any of your friends or family or followers listen to the last one?
Yeah, they've listened to it and they love it, particularly all the swear words.
It's good to be able to be in a place and a forum where you can just freestyle and you don't have to self-regulate along the way. You can just think and just say what it is you want to say without having to run it through the fucking filter first.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, the thing that surprises people is when I say, we didn't plan that shit. We just rock up and start chatting.
Like, exactly.
Unscripted.
Well, I think, I mean, for me, they're the podcasts I like listening to is when hopefully there's two interesting people, which we may or may not be, but hopefully two interesting people having an interesting, and you, Melissa, three, an interesting conversation about shit that's kind of relevant and hopefully perhaps usable and valuable for people. So now, before we start, I wanted to do this on air. What's the date of our conference? Because I want to back you into a corner. I'm actually manipulating you right now. What's
Sunday the 22nd of March.
Sunday the 22nd of March is the U Project Conference in Melbourne.
All right.
Now, I want you to commit. No pressure.
Hashtag no pressure.
I'll pay you not much money. You're welcome.
And I get to swear on stage. Is that what you're going to do for me?
You can say, g'day, motherfuckers, I'm here.
You're lucky you didn't say the 17th of March because I'd be rat-arsed.
Why? What?
That's St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, really? Yeah, you'll be shit-faced.
Yeah. I may have recovered by the 22nd.
So what's the date, the 15th?
22nd.
Oh, fuck. How's my short-term? 22nd of
March. Goldfish and across them.
Dory. 22nd of March. 22nd of March. Is that the front door or the back? So I want you to put that in your calendar because you're our opening keynote.
Maybe
closing keynote.
Right.
Yeah, we might put you down as the closing keynote. Just fucking keep everybody around. No pressure. Just be awesome. $50 too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's a David Jones voucher, but you know.
All right. 22nd of March. I'm in.
Oh, perfect.
Awesome.
Well, that's just got 50 more sales. Awesome. So I wanted to run off before. We're not going to go into it, but you and I were just having a quick chat about. The Netflix doco Game Changers.
Don't call it a doco. Okay. Documentary suggests that there's some
medical, scientific validity to it.
Yeah, exactly, and that it's balanced.
Mm. All right, so, well, we will point out that it was produced by vegans and it's about the vegan diet or promoting, and that's okay. But anyway, we're going to have, for those who are interested, Paul's going to come back in the next however long and we're going to dissect that and be as objective as we can. Mm-hmm. But just because you've had the same experience as me, which is you've been inundated with people saying you've got to watch this, you've got to watch this. I had the same thing. So rather than step onto our platform now and go off at a tangent, we'll come back when you've done – you're going to watch it again. I'm going to watch it again. We'll do a bit of research and we'll try and be as objective and as fair as we can.
Well, we can talk about the good, the bad and the ugly.
So we're gonna review the Game Changers, which if you haven't watched it, it's on Netflix. It's very well produced. It's got great backing. It's in terms of that kind of production, it's very high value.
It's very slick.
Very high production value, and it's very slick and it's very polished. So definitely worth having a look. I wanted to start with talking about identity today, where we find our sense of self from. I just wanted to swing that door. Well, and again, you didn't know any of this. We weren't prepped, but I wanted to talk to you about that because for some people, it seems to be almost like a weight that they carry when they get their sense of self or their identity or self-worth from their stuff. Their brand or their business or their money or their appearance or their muscles or their pretty face or their abs or their academic credibility or whatever. How do you navigate that with people when you're talking to them about who they are beyond their stuff?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a really big topic to unpick. And I think we need to go back to human evolution and really talk about the cognitive evolution, right? 70,000 or so years ago, when we started to really have this big, massive, you know, we had these big brains all of a sudden, and we started to realize that there was value in things. We were interacting with other tribes, we're starting to trade and all of this, and then we're starting to develop metacognition, right? And this whole metacognition thing, it just is a complete another game changer, right? Where being able to think about the fact that you can think about stuff, right? To think about, and then you get into, you know, why are we here? Why does it all exist, right? These amazing brains of ours. And we could have right now a philosophical, religious debate and go really, really deep. And it requires that really complex brain, but it is the brain that then asks all of these questions about why and why are we different from animals? And then we develop religion, right? And we develop all of that stuff. And you show me, and for me, it's all linked into this, right? Show me a religion, which there's hundreds of them. Show me one that doesn't have an afterlife opportunity, right? Because we're the dominant species on Earth, we think that there's got to be something else, right? Mosquitoes can die, and that's it, right?
But other animals
can die, but there's got to be something bigger for us, right? And this whole God created us, whatever God that may be, there's a whole heap of different, you know, created us in our own likeness. And I think we become very fucking self-important, right, with all of this stuff, which leads into all of these deeper questions about why do I exist, who am I, all of this sort of stuff that then people start to grapple with.
Do you think that we overthink some stuff, maybe what happens when you die is you just turn into fucking food for other organisms. Maybe you just become mulch. It's like that just is uncomfortable for us, Melissa. So we don't, like, you don't want to think that that's it.
No, you don't want to think that's it.
And no. Despite the fact that there's zero evidence that there's anything else. Now, I'm not saying there's nothing else, folks, so don't fucking panic. But what I'm saying is the truth is, especially with religious stuff and theories about Ask the Crab, by the way, he's got an idea. Do you know about the crab?
No.
I'll tell you in a minute. The truth is nobody knows what happens when we die, despite the fact that there's so many religions, so many ideologies, so many philosophies all pushing a certain thing. Yeah. I was listening to Paul Check today chat, and he was saying just within Christianity, there's 33,000 divisions.
Wow. There you go.
33,000 different versions or different philosophies around the original idea.
It's really interesting. And then you get, did you talk to Checky? Did you get into mystical experiences with Checky?
No, we're talking, I'm interviewing him Friday, but I was listening to him on the way here.
asking him about some of the mystical experience stuff, because I've had a little bit of a play with that.
Well, he's
in the Amazon jungle, and I know Checky's kind of into that as well.
He's an ayahuasca boy, and
yeah,
he's. I want to talk to you about that frog. I remember you doing that when you were working.
Oh,
with
the
me,
sapo.
Where you and I were. Hang on, but I want to fucking come back
right,
to.
Sorry, we're getting distracted.
Hang on, I'm all over the shop, but I just want to tell you this one thing because this will interest you. Everyone's like, fuck, there's no flow to this. Ah, oh, fucking welcome on board. There's no flow to anything. When you and me are around each other, it's like. So, you don't. So, five. You know my training partner, Mark, the crab?
No.
You would have seen him up at Harper's.
Right.
Big dude. So ex-Mr. Australia, ex-pro bodybuilder, IFBB pro.
Oh, I think he introduced me to him before, right?
Yeah. So we're training 5 Fridays ago, October 11, and he's doing a set of chins.
Yeah.
So he's like me, but bigger, strong, in shape, fit, lean, done smoke, done drink, healthy as fuck, had his heart checked recently, everything good, all his arteries, everything fine, no issues, clean bill of health. Does a set of chins, does 30 chins and holds his breath for the set, right? Sits down on a step-up box, which is just below where he did his chins, falls forward, dies.
What?
Has a cardiac arrest, right?
Holy Jesus. Yeah, yeah. Well, I wonder what his blood pressure was like when he was doing that.
4 million over 2 million. yeah. So, but literally from the start of the set, he goes.
I take it he's not dead, no.
He's not dead right, now, but he was dead for 17 minutes.
Ah, right. Okay.
And according to him, not much there.
Yeah.
Nothing. But he does say, I don't know. I wasn't. But interesting.
But there's other people who have these experiences and the tunnel, the white light.
Mm.
That shit's DMT, right? Mm. DMT's released.
That's your brain producing DMT when you're nearing death.
Yeah. At birth and at death, nearing death, there's DMT. And then the starving of oxygen in your like serotonergic neurons go crazy and your life kind of flashes in front of you. Mm. Anybody's had a mystical experience, anybody's taken ayahuasca, can tell you about that shit.
And DMT is dimethyltryptamine
it's the active ingredient in ayahuasca.
Tell people what ayahuasca is.
So ayahuasca is a plant, and I got interested because at university I started doing a master's degree in it wasn't in shape, social anthropology, but we did one thing on witchcraft and shamanism, and I started to become really interested in it. Mm. And then I buggered off. I didn't finish it. I went off traveling and experienced it. So I wanted to go and experience it. Mm. So I've spent a reasonable amount of time in the Amazon jungle 20 odd years ago with shamans before all the ayahuasca tourism happened. So ayahuasca is a brew that the shamans use in South America. Mm. And there's different types of shamans. There's
plant medicine, they call
yeah, plant medicine,
they?
Right?
Yeah.
So there's curandos and ayahuasqueros. So curandos basically are healers. So they use the plant, teaches them, talks to them, and tells them what's wrong and what they can do about it. And then the ayahuasqueros take you on a journey, a spiritual journey, right? Mm. So, and it's really interesting. It's the vine Banisteros capri or something like that. So it goes, and I've cacked my own off, but you need to, there's an active ingredient in it that's inhibited by an enzyme in the human gut.
Mm.
But when you cook it with a leaf called the chikungunya leaf, that inhibits the enzyme in the gut that inhibits the ingredient in ayahuasca. And then there's something in the chikungunya leaf that the combination of those two things is it's basically the Everest of hallucinogens. and
the Michael Jordan of getting off your rocks.
Yeah. And so, but you do it with a shamanic guide.
Yeah.
So the shaman is experienced in taking you into the underworld. And they say that ayahuasca unlocks the key to the underworld, right?
Mm.
And interesting, I listened to a podcast the other day, Michael Pollan, you know him, the journalist? He's done In Defense of Food and stuff like that. He's an investigative journalist type thing. And he's now written a book on mystical experiences.
Mm.
So there's a whole heap of... But anyway, so that's what it is. And they will take you... you basically go on a journey into the underworld.
So tell us about yours, though.
So I had what is described as a mystical experience. So there's actually psychologists, you know, they've got a fucking a questionnaire for everything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They got a questionnaire on mystical experience. So I went and looked it up and went, yep, I did that. So out-of-body experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a complete out-of-body experience where that sense of time was completely warped as you go into it. So when you take, you drink this stuff,
yeah,
and it's disgusting,
yeah,
right? It is just minging.
And you poo and spew. And
you throw up. Yeah. And after a little bit of time, you throw up like there's no tomorrow, right?
Mm.
And then as soon as you throw up, you're kind of, but it just hits you and you lose all sense of control of your body.
Yeah.
And you basically lie down and then, the only way I can describe it is that your consciousness both explodes and implodes at the same time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Michael Pollan talked about DMT as the only one he didn't like because he just said, you just got no idea whether there's a reality. Mm. He describes it much better than I do.
Mm.
But basically, you just go into that point where you feel quite edgy and then all of a sudden, boom, the whole, your consciousness explodes.
Mm.
It's like you just become a part of the universe and it becomes a part of you. It's really quite weird, but you feel a really deep sense of connectedness.
Mm.
And this is why they're actually using it. And in the ayahuasca church in Brazil, and there's one now in Canada, they've got a really high cure rate for drug addicts and alcoholics and stuff like that, who generally lose a sense of connection.
Mm.
That's another little pathway that we can go down anyway. But that was my overriding sense of it. And the concept of time, you go into this and you're like, time is just, it's a nothing concept anymore.
Yeah.
It could be like, I could be in this for 3 seconds or I could be in this for a million years, right?
Mm.
So it's a bit unnerving as you go in, and then when you relax into it, it's pretty nuts.
Was it transformative or was it just an experience
I felt, and I've had a number of experiences with the shaman, I felt that it was quite a transformative experience for me, in that after having done a number of these things, I felt, for me, it's a much greater sense of contentment around things. You feel a little bit more connected with stuff. You know, that whole sort of, What am I doing? All of that just kind of disappeared.
Why am I here? What's it about? What's my purpose?
And it was much more of that understanding. And I got a very strong sense of that integration with the universe. And then for me, led me to, for me, it really underscored the kind of belief that I have, because I was a recovering Catholic at the time and thought, you know, I don't think there is a God. And I was struggling, am I an atheist? Am I agnostic? And then it was really, for me, after that, it was all about energy.
Mm.
So for me, everything's about energy. And it was almost like on some of the ayahuasca journeys I went on, that I could see the atoms and I could feel the connections at an atomic level between me and people and me and the forest and all of that sort of stuff, which is why these guys have a much greater sense of connection. They think they're at one with the forest. You know, when you talk to these shamans and these, we went, me and Giovanni, this Italian guy, went on this 2-3 week expedition deep into the Amazon jungle with shamanic guides to visit the Matsis people, who believe that they are completely intertwined with the forest. Now, the interesting thing, right? What's the chances of somebody by luck coming across those two plants? Like, you think of the hundreds of millions of plants, the factorial of that combination.
Oh, yeah. Logistic.
Billions to one, right?
Yeah.
And I asked the shaman about this and he said the plants are our teachers.
Yeah, the plants talk to us and tell us.
Right, which is a strange concept for us to understand get our heads around.
But part of the problem with some of this, or part of the challenge with this, is we look at what they do and where they are and their language and their reality through our window, and of course it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
of course it's ridiculous.
That's exactly, and you know, I'm not being a politician about the first question you asked me. It was about identity, and for me, it's all tied back to this.
Yeah,
which is about your experiences, your belief system. So the Matsis Indians have a very different belief system than we actually do, and I think we have no idea how much our belief system actually shapes it, right? And then, you know, fast forward to today, and some of the breakdown in those societies that we're having and with living in the world of consumerism, I think this is why we're struggling so much with the whole mental health piece, right? But to get back and answer your last question, so for me, afterwards, I felt a much deeper sense of contentment, and I feel that there's that when you die, your energy just changes, right? Yeah. We're just energy at one level, at a quantum level, particularly we're just energy, and the energy just, you know, energy can't be destroyed or created; it just gets transformed into something else, right? But for me, death's the last great journey of life. Right. Yeah. Nobody fucking knows.
Yeah.
And you won't know until you go into it. And if fuck all happens, you won't know any better.
Well, it's impossible to know.
Yeah.
While you're alive, it's impossible to know.
Which is why religion, you know, they put up these straw man arguments about God, and you know, if you question God, you get persecuted for, you know, and they do that for a couple of thousand years, and then all of a sudden people start to believe in it.
Well, I grew up in two really distinct religious cultures, firstly as a Catholic and then as an evangelical Christian.
Right.
So fucking, it's a wonder I can string four words together. but I learned stuff in both places, right? But the moment that, especially as in that evangelical spaces, the moment that I ever would question anything, I was told, well, that's the devil. Literally, that's what I was told.
Yeah.
Oh, that's Satan.
Yeah.
The father of lies.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
No. So doubt or, but I'm like, no. But this is a good question, though. It's not. No, you just have to believe. I'm like, kinda.
Yeah.
But I need a little bit more.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's not God. Well, isn't it? What What do you think lies at the intersection of psychology, physiology, and spirituality? Is there an intersect there? And is what we call a spiritual experience really just a biochemical experience? Or is the biochemical the door that opens?
Yeah, look, it's really, really interesting. For me, I'm very interested in where that whole, the biology, the spiritual and the quantum mechanics, where that all kind of mixes in together, right?
That intersection there.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating intersection, right? That because really all your brain is a bunch of neurons firing together that and there's consciousness that arises, right?
Yes.
So consciousness is your mind, your consciousness, and then, you know, we have these thoughts and this whole identity thing that is basically created out of our consciousness. But then there's all of that energetic stuff that's actually going on as well. And then you throw religion on it and stuff like that. But so I think it's a very interesting nexus that there's going to be a whole heap more exploration. I encourage people to go and explore it themselves, right? This is the next wave of exploration is kind of getting into that stuff.
Do you think that part of the fascination, I don't know if it's just that I'm more aware of it or it's actually bigger and there's momentum around the spiritual and the, you know, that more kind of philosophical approach to thinking and living, that we've smashed the, you know, the life is about stuff. Life is about what you earn, what you own, what you drive, commercialism, corporate this, bank balance. Nothing wrong with any of that. But when that's kind of, when that's your religion or when that's your philosophy is what I can get and have and earn and own and look like and what people think of me, then you get to the point where you go, well, it doesn't matter how much stuff I get or how much stuff I do, there's still this hole.
Yeah.
Is that there's still this internal
existential hole.
There's this void that doesn't matter what's going on in terms of the external picture from the outside looking in. Like I've had this experience, which I won't bore everyone with again, but when I had a point in my life where from the outside looking in, I was killing it, and from the inside out, I felt shit house.
Yeah.
And it was because I'd kind of built this paradigm of life is about, you know, all of my energy was about getting and doing and achieving and box ticking, and there was something innately missing.
Yeah, well, I don't think necessarily you built that. I think our modern society has built that, and really through advertising and consumerism has built that, and that has coincided with this move away from religion, right? And religion kind of came up and moved us away from the whole tribal society, right? And all of it is really quite well summed up, I think, by the ancient Greeks, who talked about the engaged life and the meaningful life and those sorts of things, and the whole hedonia versus eudaimonia.
Yeah.
So the hedonia is about the pleasures of the senses, the material things, and all of that. Yeah. And the eudaimonia part is much deeper, and it's much more. Traditional, it's about acceptance of self, acceptance of others, connection with others, being socially integrated, being socially interested, about environmental mastery, about autonomy, and about purpose in life, right? Mm. Those deeper things that are to do with others. And really, I think that has hit it on the head, and it's about being part of something that's bigger than yourself. Mm. I think that's what the religious and the tribal is, and they both offer people, and why they feel, people who are deeply religious generally feel much more fulfilled than people who aren't, right? But people who have that sense of connection, that sense of purpose in life, and generally it's about others, are as fulfilled as people who are religious or who are deeply spiritual. For all of the three of them, I think the magic comes out of being part of something that's bigger than yourself, right? And that whole, what the Greeks call eudaimonia.
What's the stuff that you're doing at the moment with companies? So you're like me, you're in front of audiences all the time. Yeah. What do audiences want? What do companies want now with you? Why do they bring you in?
Yeah. So now more and more it's around resilience and that whole stress management piece. And because they're starting to realize that people aren't just expendable assets, and that it's a real short-term game to drive people, to the brink of where we drive them into burnout. Mm. So they're actually starting to really think about, we need to invest in our people. Yes, we need to work hard and get some out of them, but we also need to give them skills, and we also need to make sure that we're not burning them out. Because I see it a lot, particularly I deal more with executives, and people are highly, highly stressed, right? And they're working their nuts off, absolutely busting their nuts to try and get ahead in life. And then they're actually doing it, and they're not spending time with their kids. They're not spending time with their families. They're becoming, even though they're successful, they're starting to become distressed. They're starting to become burned out, right? And we know that you can handle much more stress if you can derive meaning from it, right? If it's meaningful for you. And we've talked about this before, about having ikigai. If you're really into what you're doing and you're really passionate about it, then it doesn't seem so stressful. But if you're just there to pick up a wage check, then that stress is amplified, right? So in short, really, it's the whole resilience piece I'm finding more and more. I do stuff around high performance teams, but the resilience piece is the thing that really seems to bring value.
And I think, like whether or not it's a news agency or it's BHP or it's a gym or it's a fucking panel beaters, like whatever the business, whatever the size, whatever the product you sell, whatever the service you deliver, whatever the situation or environment, all businesses are driven by humans, and every human's got an ego, an attitude, a personality, physical, mental, emotional, social needs.
Yeah.
And then you plonk them in this thing, kind of like a, a cog in a corporate machine, and say, right, this is what you do. And I think when we don't take into account people's personal welfare, which is the stuff that you're doing, like you're actually doing, not only are you doing your people a disservice, but you're doing your business a disservice.
Absolutely.
Because you're getting people who are physically, mentally, emotionally turning up to work three out of 10.
Yeah.
So now you've got this guy or this girl who's technically well-qualified, educated, intelligent, but they're fucking dreading going to work.
Yeah.
Because it's like this psychological and emotional prison that they step into every day, where, they just don't, they're not thriving, they're just surviving.
Yeah.
And I think for me anyway, I reckon part of the challenge is that sometimes the people who lead those teams, themselves aren't in a good place.
Well, and I think you get to the values of the organization as well, because you have some of those people who are turning up just exactly as you described, and then you have the other people who are turning up who are really passionate about it and are really engaged, because some businesses that have good values and are there, but they're just overworked.
Yeah.
To the point that they then implode. And yeah. And you know what it's like. It's like overtrained athletes, right? Yeah. Once you go into that burnout,
yeah,
you've just toasted a highly valuable asset.
Yeah.
And then the replacement costs of replacing that asset is enormous.
Yes.
And this is what organizations are starting to realize. Even the ones that are just all about profit are realizing, actually, financially, that's not good to burn them out. But then there's another set of organizations that are going, this isn't the right thing to do. The right thing to do is to look after our people. And I think they're all having the come to Jesus moment, some by for different reasons than others, but they're all realizing.
Some for selfish reasons.
That's right.
Others not, yeah.
Others not, but all realizing, actually, we need to look after our people, that we can't just work. We can't just treat them as expendable assets.
Mm. Yeah, there's been a real shift in that, I think. And one of the things that, when I'm talking to somebody, I was somewhere recently and there was a guy who said, what do you talk? Who was it? Might've been at the gym maybe, but this dude has a company and he said, so what do you talk about? Like, you're in that corporate space. Mm. What do you talk about? I said, I talk about people stuff. I go, I don't really talk about business stuff at all. I'm actually not very good at business.
Yeah.
It's not really my thing. I'm okay at it. I've done it. I can do it. Not passionate about business. I'm not great at business. I go, but I'm not bad with humans. We're thinking and behaving and creating shift. And he's like, well, how do you make that work? I go, well, every business has got humans in it. Mm. So, you know, irrespective of, like I said, the brand, product, service, if we can have a culture and a team and a kind of a communication that is, for the most part, somewhere between pretty good and really good a lot of the time, that's a really nice platform to do business. But you know, and I don't know if I said this in a podcast with you, but I don't know if anyone else uses this term, but I talk about, rather than work-life balance, I talk about work impact.
Yeah.
And so for me, that is the impact that work has on your physical, mental, and emotional well-being.
Yep.
So you might do 20 hours of something you fucking hate. It's going to be more detrimental than me doing 80 hours of something I love.
That's right. Yeah,
so it's not about necessarily volume or hours or, you know, that's a variable that matters.
Mm.
But if you are doing something that is analogous to just fun or joy or passion or purpose, then you don't, as cheesy as it sounds, you don't feel like you're working. Like I wrote today something on, what did I write? Something about I haven't had a job since I was 26. Like I feel, because I've always done my own shit, I literally, that's 30 years, I feel like I haven't worked. Even though I work a lot, but in terms of, I remember having a job. I remember having to be there at a certain time, leave at a certain time, have a boss. Not that that's a bad thing, but for me, I realized early, I'm not great at being an employee. I can do it, but it's not where I thrive. You know, so for me, just creating that and doing, and there are, of course, there was pressure with building a gym and building a business and stepping into an industry that didn't yet exist with personal training, and I fucked up and I had peaks and troughs, but I never hated it.
Yeah,
I always, you know, I kind of reveled in it, even in the the troughs.
And look, there's a lot of science to back up what you say. So DC and Ryan, self-determination theory, have applied this to work as well.
Yeah.
Right? And we know the highest form of motivation is being intrinsically motivated, right? That helps in health behavior change if you do something because you love it. And people at work, right?
Yep.
If they're intrinsically motivated, they can deal with a lot more and it doesn't feel like stress.
Mm.
But then there's that whole continuum of motivation, of external motivation, right? Mm. Right from right down at the bottom, people who only work whenever the boss is looking, it's carrots and sticks, right? But you can drive people up to the highest form of extrinsic motivation by actually saying, look, Craig, I know this is really shitty work that I'm asking you to do, or I know this is a really hard period, but this is why it's really important for the goals and the values of the organization, or this is why what you're doing is really important for the team, or how this is actually creating something, right? So when you have an emotional or you have a connection to the why you're actually doing it, you can handle much more stress, right?
Yeah.
You give much more effort. And it's the military had it nailed, right?
Yes.
Everybody in the military in that mission knew the importance of their role, right down to the chef in the galley,
right? And how
what they were doing on a daily basis was contributing to the overall good of the team and the organization. And that's when I work with leaders around leadership, a lot of it is about helping people to see how their work is important on a daily basis. And ideally, when you can get people to emotionally connect to the goals and values of the organization, that only works in some, right? It doesn't work in a bank, but it does work in some. When they do that, they give much more discretionary effort. So I work with the managers and say the most important thing you can do is sit down with your people and work with them to help them find out how what they're doing on a daily basis is important to the team and to the organization.
And irrespective of whether or not it's a football team or a bank or BHP or whatever, people want to feel valued and connected and like they matter.
And they want a feeling of contribution, right? And they want to feel like there's something that's bigger than themselves, right? And they need clarity of expectation, right? Those things are all, and the opportunity to grow. Right, feeling like I'm contributing to something, feeling like I belong to something, and feeling like I'm given an opportunity to grow and being clear about what I'm doing. They're the four big things that go into employee engagement, right?
I remember I intro'd you one day, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you got a master's in nutrition, master in ex-phys, postgrad in, don't tell me, neuroscience, a couple of other things. We're in the Royal Marines. Is that what it's called?
Navy.
Royal Navy, Navy, sorry. And you're doing your PhD in psych.
Yep.
At UTAS.
Good effort.
What are you doing your PhD around?
Resilience.
Okay. So what do you know now that you didn't know? And what do you want to share with us around that?
Yeah.
That's part one. And part two is, not is there a shortcut, but is there a bit of a hack where, or is there something that we can do that kind of works so we get a bit of payoff? To build resilience that's not going to take 3 years?
Yeah, okay. So let's start off with what I'm doing. So typically, resilience is measured by the absence of psychopathology after traumatic experience or prolonged stress.
Say that again.
So the absence of psychopathology. So after exposure to a stressful period.
Right. So in other words,
I don't have PTSD. I don't have anxiety. I don't have depression.
So you still got your shit together, but you went through some stuff. So
that's
So you managed it.
Yeah. And what they do is they measure it post hoc. So post event, right? So I've gone through a war zone, or I've gone through trauma. I've been, that sort of stuff. Do I have PTSD, anxiety, depression? No. And then they have these surveys that they do, resilience surveys, and they find that people with anxiety, depression, PTSD score differently than people who don't have it, right? So that's your score on a resilience survey.
Right.
So what they then do is they bring that pre-event and say, right, Paul and Craig, you haven't been through trauma yet, but take the same survey and let's see how you score.
And then we're going to traumatize you.
But what they do is they then link that to the people post, right?
Right.
And so they use that as a kind of a proxy predictor.
Right.
But it's pretty friggin' loose, right?
Yes.
And we know that people in questionnaires aren't good, right?
Yes.
And particularly if it's in a workplace, lots of them lie.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
So there's all sorts of stuff going on, and it's an in the moment thing and stuff like that, right? So that's one measure in how they've typically done it. And there's people are don't all exactly agree on what resilience is and how to measure it, but that's roughly where we're at, right? But interesting, and I'm going up to Newcastle next week to see Eugene get trained in this method that they published a paper that basically did acoustic startle response. So basically the three of us would have headphones on and would be given a task, and you'd be there doing it for 20 minutes. And then at random intervals over a period of 15, 20 minutes, a loud bang would go off in the headphones and scare the shit out of you, right? And we're all wired up. So we're wired up to our blood pressure. Your blood pressure will actually come back to normal.
Yay!
So you'd have an increase in blood pressure, galvanic skin response, heart rate response, all of that. So you're all wired up and everybody has a, oh, shit, right? What happens is over time, if if, say, you two are resilient, over time, after 5, 6, 7, 8, you'll be going, oh, there's that thing again. Whereas I'm going, fuck, every time it happens. Right, so I don't habituate. Right. So this is a biological correlate of resilience, that habituation, because we see there's differences in people who have PTSD, anxiety, depression, or other psychopathology in how they habituate, right? So this is quite cool. So what I'm then working on. I have a
funny story to tell you around this. Yep, okay, keep going.
No, so the third element is what one of my PhD supervisors he's the head psych charged with enhancing cognitive fitness of the armed forces, which is performance under pressure. And they believe and have a pretty good reason to believe in, and it's pretty obvious that if I can perform under pressure, I'm less likely to suffer psychopathology after prolonged period of stress, right?
Yes.
So that's what they are interested in.
Yes.
Can we go pre-event and can we enhance people's ability to be able to perform under pressure?
Yeah.
Right? So there's those three things. So what I'm doing is I'm testing on a bunch of people we're going to measure all three of those things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we're going to see, can we do an intervention that improves those three things?
Mm.
And then afterwards, are they connected? Are those do those three things triangulate? Because if they do, we now have a gold standard measure of resilience, right?
Mm.
But what I'm also really interested in is what Eugene, my supervisor, is interested in is that what he calls cognitive fitness, and he's written papers on it, that ability to perform under pressure. What we're going to do then is we're going to bring the people in. We're going to give them certain, whether it's a word processing task or a neuropsych battery where we can score them objectively. Then we'll bring them back and we'll stress the shit out of them. Right?
Love it. I fucking love it.
Sleep deprived or whatever it may be, cognitive loads will have them really stressed, and then repeat the test.
Yeah.
So you get really good objective measures, and does their performance improve under pressure, right? Then how does it correlate with those other two measures?
I fucking love it. So I'm going to do a little plug here because I just thought of something. I don't even have the date. So I think it's January 6th. Am I doing that thing with Brad Cunningham from the Fit Shop?
I believe so.
Doesn't matter. I think it is. But I've got about three things I want to tell you. I love that. Pursuant to that, Your Honor. So I was actually thinking about this. I reckon one of the biggest predictors of success or failure, for want of better terms, is an individual's ability to be able to deal with stress or manage. You know, can you perform under pressure, whether or not it's football, public speaking, academia, whatever. Can you do shit when it's hard? Can you execute when you not when it's comfortable and familiar and you've had a great sleep and it's 7 in the morning and your brain's clear, but can you do stuff? And so I contacted Brad, who owns a PT center, and I said to him, I want to do a program as kind of almost like a trial. What do you call it? First thing?
Pilot.
Pilot. Thank you. Fuck, I need some omega-3s. And I wanted to do something where we combine training and cognitive training, physical and cognitive.
Yeah.
So I'm doing this program. It'll be announced soon, but it's, and sorry, folks, it's only in Victoria, but we're going to do 3 sessions a week. And it's called, the program's called Disrupt Your Life, right?
Yeah.
And it's all about, in an intelligent way, getting people used to dealing with a little bit of physical, mental, and emotional discomfort with a view to helping them build physical, mental, and emotional resilience.
Yeah.
12 sessions, 3 weeks. But we're not training. I'm not sure yet. But it's either going to be 9 or 9.30 at night. So it's really fucking, it's a shit time.
Yeah.
It's really inconvenient. And people are going to go, oh, I'm not going to get home till 12. I go, correct. Correct.
Suck it up, princess.
You might be a bit sleep deprived. You won't die. It's not cancer. It's just a bit of tiredness. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That part of the process is to do shit that's inconvenient, unfamiliar, unconventional. It's not instant gratification. This is the whole point, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that really matters. The second thing I was going to tell you before you expand was that you know, that exposure to that thing that stresses you or creates that response. So Melissa knows this, but I did a gig in Queenstown in New Zealand last year.
Did you do a bungee jump?
No, fuck that. That's a stress response I'm going to avoid. But I did anyway. I did a half day with I can't remember the company. God bless them. But anyway, it was a bunch of people, and we were talking about financial planners. Thank you. We were talking about you know, all this stuff, just managing life's like stressful, blah blah blah. And then I said, put up your hand if you are. And I was talking about this whole idea of desensitizing yourself to something so that what scared you doesn't scare you.
Yep.
So that, you know, instead of your stress response being 10, it's now a 7, and then it's a 5, and then and then eventually it, maybe you actually enjoy it. I said, put up your hand if you're terrified of public speaking, and everyone maybe scared, and a bunch of hands went up. And I said, put your hands in it. Now put up your hand if you're fucking terrified, and about 3 hands went up. And this lady had a hand up. I go, how terrified are you of it? And she goes, from her seat, would hardly even look at me or talk to me. I go, can you come here for a moment? She shakes her head, goes, no, no, no. I go, no, I'm not going to make you do any public speaking. And she's like, I go, I'm not going to. You just come down here, I promise, right? So she comes down. I take off my lapel mic and I put it on her. So here's my plan, because I'm a fucking genius. I'm going to demonstrate how we can desensitize her and take the fear from a 9 to a 1 or an 11 to a 1, and I'm fucking 400 people looking at me. I've got this sorted. They'll be so impressed. So I put the microphone on her and I go, don't look at them, just look at me. I go, you don't need to turn around, talk to the audience, do a presentation. I go, just be in the moment with me. So I turn facing her and the audience to our side, off to her left, my right. And I'm talking to her and I go, so how long have you been a financial planner or whatever? And I go, and did you have it, like, are you staying here or are you just traveling to the conference each day? And she's going, not bad. And then she's kind of talking and then she turns and looks at the audience, right? And she just goes white. And I go, don't look at them, look at me. I go, fuck them, just look at me. And then she keeps talking and then she fainted. She fell on me. She fucking just collapsed, right? So she collapses and I'm catching this lady going, well, this isn't working out. And about 400 people are like, you fucking idiot. And so fair to say there was a bit of redeeming to do, but didn't exactly prove my point, Paul.
No.
Just one of those moments where you go, this usually works. Today, not so much.
Yeah. So it's what the military refer to as preconditioning training.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and what I went through, combat survival and resistance to interrogation training, is to prepare you for the eventuality of potentially being captured and interrogating. Mm. And what they do is they load you up with a whole heap of stressors so that if you ever eventuate into that scenario, that you have had some prior exposure, right? So that preconditioning actually increases your tolerance. But to your point, what we found out at the end of it was that when we were getting interrogated, and this is the after 10 days of sleep deprivation, the only food we got was a chicken between 4 people, and it was alive when we got it. And you know, we were just thrashed for 10 days. Then we were exposed to white noise for 12 hours, stress positions, and then we got interrogated. Afterwards, they said to us that they had psychologists, military psychologists, watching us in the cells through the little cameras.
Yeah.
And all the interrogators had earphones in.
Yeah.
And they were saying, just back off this guy a little bit. He's about to crack. This guy, you can push a little bit further. Yeah. So they were wanting to take everybody
to their threshold.
Towards their threshold, right? Mm. So you don't want to go over it like you did with that lady.
Clearly, I don't have military training or somebody in my ear going, back off, you fucking idiot. She's about to, there she goes.
Yeah, and now she's got PTSD.
Yeah, exactly. And she has flashbacks of me, wakes up in the middle of the night, sees my fucking face on the roof, starts sweating. Lawsuit pending. Do you think that this is not the right term, but our addiction to or our attraction to comfort is part of our problem?
I think it's a huge part of the problem, a massive part of the problem. And I'm particularly thankful now that I did choose to go and join the military, because I think it really, really helped, particularly that combat survival training. Mm. That's where I had my aha moments that it was all about hormesis. And I think we are losing hormetic stimuli in our lives. And
what does that mean?
I'm actually thinking of creating a program around the hormetic lifestyle. Hormesis is about sublethal exposure to stressors or toxins that at high levels can kill you, at low to moderate levels induce stress resistance, right? And summed up by Nietzsche, that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger, right? And right from childhood, no good shit ever happened in your comfort zone, right? That's not where we grow. I think we've talked about this before. Yeah. It's where you're out of your comfort zone, that zone of productive disequilibrium, where you are exposed to stress for a certain amount of period, and then that's followed by recovery. That's how you grow. And exercise is a hormetic stressor. We now know that actually radiation, my father-in-law is a radiologist, and I've chatted to him about this. They're taught that any exposure to radiation is harmful. And it's not true. There's countless amounts of study showing that low-level exposure to nuclear radiation or any form of radiation actually is beneficial. And because what it does is it stimulates adaptive gene expression responses internally, right? So our endogenous antioxidant defense mechanisms, those genes get upregulated because of exposure. There's a whole heap of genes that get upregulated because of a release of stress response proteins. So they have another cascade of gene expression that they trigger off, and then there's a third one that's triggered off. So actually, it's all evolution is it's wrapped up in hormesis. And I think what's happening is that well-intentioned parents want to protect their kids. And the news, that doesn't help, because we think there's fucking pedophiles everywhere, right? And there's no more incidents of pedophiles than there were in the 1950s. It's just that you hear about everything everywhere, right? And that news is all negative, right? So, and people want to protect little Johnny and take him away and you know, don't want him to be uncomfortable and all this. Don't want them to climb trees because they might fall off and break. And we're bringing up battery kids rather than free range kids. I think that's where it all starts. And I think the role of the parent is to be the guide by the side, to let them actually climb trees, to let them feel, and then just be around to pick them up, not to protect them. This helicopter parenting, I think, is a really bad thing. Then when you combine it with the world of consumerism that we have, and now the kids that are being brought up these days have got this other thing of social media laid over, where they see all of these people and influencers putting all these shots on going, you can be fucking anything you want to be, and all this horse shit. And they look at them and they feel inadequate. Right? And they're not brought up with the coping skills to deal with life, right? Like, the old traditional way damaged some people, for sure it did. But I think for a lot of people, it helped them to grow and to deal with stress and to actually adapt.
Well, there's a space in the middle between, you know, what some kids went through, which was complete shit, and now where the pendulum seems to have swung. We're actually... I've had this conversation, and it's hard for me because I'm not a parent, but I'm still an observer of human behavior, and where I think sometimes we're producing kids that they're going to step out of childhood into adulthood and be weak and dysfunctional and scared of everything and unskilled and incapable of dealing with stress or adversity or discomfort or pain or rejection or criticism because mum and dad ran interference for fucking 20 years and put them in the bubble. And it's understandable, but it's like ironically not love.
No, it's
not love. It's coming from a good place, but it's not producing a good outcome.
It's doing them a disservice. Absolutely. And I struggle. I often tell this. I struggle with the fact that I'm bringing up my kids in a bubble within a bubble within a bubble.
Yeah.
Right. I'm bringing them up in Australia.
I can't believe you don't have fucking roll call at your joint at 0500. Right, you little fuckers, get out of bed and fall in now.
Well,
I don't care that you're three. Eyes to me, civilian.
So we sat our kids down when they were 4 and 9, I think, and said, right, kids, because I talked to my wife about it, right? Because we're in a bubble of Australia. We're in the bubble of Mount Eliza, which you know, right?
It's fancy as fuck.
Yeah. And then they go to these wonderful schools with these amazing teachers, and they're brought up in a bubble within a bubble within a bubble. So I spoke to Carly about it, because I really struggle with particularly being brought up in Belfast as a Catholic living in a Protestant neighborhood, right? And And my first, she vetoed my first suggestion, which was taking him through combat survival and resistance to interrogation training for
Carly,
kids.
Carly, come on. Seems fair. Seems reasonable. Didn't hurt your husband.
Yeah, that's right. Tick, tick. But we sat down and we thought sport.
Yeah.
Competitive sport. So we sat our kids down and said, here's the gig, kids. You need to do a team sport and a martial art.
Yeah.
You need to pick whatever you want. We don't care. Mm. We'll support you. But you've got to keep doing them. And the day you stop either, you need to pack your bags and find somewhere else to live. Because they're the house rules.
Wow.
Because I think sport, competitive sport, I'm not talking about everybody gets a fucking medal sport. I'm talking about competitive sport.
Well, that's not sport.
Yeah.
That's a pastime.
Competitive sport is really good for life. And I think a martial art and a team sport, they have overlapping circles of benefits, right? And
can I suggest BJJ and not anything with striking for the children, so they do
karate and they do kumite. Okay. There's a few little knocks, but you know they've got headgear and stuff like that. BJJ would be great, but particularly the karate has been awesome for them, right? Overcoming fears and learning that you know life's not just not fair, right? Our kids have been in terms of, you know, you video it and they go, I should have had a point there. The referee didn't see it. Yeah. You know what? That's shit.
How old are your kids?
They're now 13 and 9.
As Mike Tyson says, that great philosopher, everyone's got a plan till they get punched in the face.
That's right. Exactly.
It's a fucking great equalizer.
Well, yeah. And the military's one is no battle plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. So you see him, right?
So then it's improvise, adapt, overcome from there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And knowing that you can actually do that.
Yeah.
Knowing that you've done it before,
yeah.
I think is really important. It gives people the confidence to then to go into those situations. Right?
So what is martial arts doing for your kids that they wouldn't be getting outside if they weren't doing it?
Look, the thing I think is the discipline and the respect. I mean, all of Oscar's teachers, he said, because he started when he was 4.
Right.
And I remember he first went in and his first sensei, Adam, who was awesome, was all about respect. And Oscar is the most respectful student, right? He's unbelievable, right? And I think that's come from karate.
Is he 9 or 13?
He's 9, right? Yeah. And I think the discipline, the hard work, the understanding that success comes from hard work. And, you know, we've overlaid a bit of Carol Dweck's growth mindset stuff.
Yeah.
But understanding that you have to work really, really hard at stuff. And that you can become good at it if you work at it.
Yeah.
And that understanding that, you know, you get better from actually competing with people who are better than yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And that you either win or you learn. Right?
Yeah.
There's always, if you don't win, there's always a learning in it, right?
Is he good at it?
He's Australian champion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he won the Australian Open last year for 9-year-olds when he was 8. And he wasn't even, they messed up the registration.
Look at you just flying under the radar with, I didn't even know. I was like, he could have been.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, and Kira's Victorian champion, Australian schools champion, Australian Open runner-up. And runner-up in the Australian Nationals. Oscar's runner-up in the Nationals as well.
Amazing.
So but they've got, you know, they got a great sensei, but they work really, really hard. Mm. And they also do mental skills training, which I think is a missing piece.
That's amazing. This is a naive question because I don't know. Are there different... is a kid's black belt not the same as a grown-up's black belt?
It is after a certain age.
Right.
So
they both, what belts are they?
Oscar's brown, Kira's brown black. She's going for a black next year.
And so when she gets her black as a 14-year-old, will that be the same as a lady with a black?
Yeah. Wow. Absolutely.
No, do you need to be a little careful about you say?
Every time I walk past them, I get beaten up.
Do they sweep your legs and then just ground and pound you?
And Kira, you got to give her a cuddle and she, boom, punches you in the stomach and stuff. But I train with my kids, which is awesome. And I started doing karate last year. Right?
Yeah.
And Kira warmed me up for my first fight. And so she's warming me up on the mitts.
So you had a fight?
Yeah.
Of course you did.
Yeah. And so she's warming me up on the mitts. And every now and then she's stopping and giving me a big cuddle because she was just, she was so loving it that, you know,
really?
Dad was on there doing karate. So the thing I'm doing it for is just creating memories. So we've all got a goal that all three of us want to get into the state team this year.
That's amazing.
And it's fucking hard when you've got soccer players' hips.
Well, and fucking 48-year-olds' hips or whatever. Yeah, fucking let's right. Never mind. How often do you do that?
A couple of times a week. I go to squad.
How old are you?
I'm 48.
I fucking love that you took that up at 47.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when you were working with me up at Harper's, you also had a fight when you were about 40 or...
Yeah, that's right.
Or maybe that was after...
I started at about 30. I had a professional fight when I was 41.
Amazing.
It was Deal against Deal... what's his name? He used to come... So it was Deal Westerman who trained me, but there was the other Deal who...
Not Dale Cronin.
No, Dale Cronin. No.
No.
Anyway, but yeah, that was a great experience as well.
And
that
so was, how have you found as a 48-year-old in a sport that's about largely power, speed, flexibility, balance, coordination?
Yeah.
And you're like 6'1" or 2.
Yeah, I struggle.
Yeah.
So at squad, I'm in the squad's cadets and above. So Kira's age and above.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously the oldest in squad. Actually, there's some guy who's now joined who's a bit older than me, which is great. But we're in there sparring and it's full on.
Yeah.
And I have the shit kicked out of me every week. There's this guy, Mason, who is a 7-time national champion. He's 18. And he just, when we're sparring, he just tries to do hook kicks on the head with me. And
awesome.
He just always gets me out of nowhere. And I think, where the fuck did that come from? I just get kicked in the head. Where the fuck did that come from? And he just
that's not going to help your PhD.
No, it's not. But it's just little taps, right? Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. In karate, it's a little tap.
Yeah.
Which is why I love it, because it's combat, but it's not that risky, right?
Yeah.
But so my thing is, if I'm training with all those young guys and they're faster, that's going to help me to adapt whenever I go.
Hang out with people who drag you up.
Absolutely.
You know, I always say, if you're the smartest person in the room, go to another room.
That's it. Yeah.
It's like, you're the... If you're the smartest and you stay there, you're not that smart. Yeah. So we're nearly ready to wind up, but you told me before we came on air that you're about to start writing a book, or what's that going to be about?
It's going to be about mental vitality, right? And brackets, how to sort your shit out, right? I need to make sure you don't have the title, but it's the kind of sort of stuff that you, and it's all about the stuff that we're talking about. It's all about what do you do about mental health, and not just for me, it's not just about absence of illness, but how do I go to flourishing?
Yes.
How do I go to a point where I'm actually fully engaged with life and I have that mental vitality? So that's what it's going to be about.
I talk about my version of that as being a high performer, but I do a talk called Being a High Performer in Business and Life. And people think I'm going to come in and talk about elite athletes and Nobel Prize winners and astronauts. I go, no. We're talking about you getting the most out of you.
Yeah.
So you're thriving, not surviving. So whatever it is, that wherever you are, whether or not you're 56, 26, 36, a genetic freak or, you know, uncoordinated or an IQ of 75 or 175, it's all about you optimizing what you've got. You can't change what you've got.
Yeah.
You can't change your age or you can manipulate your genetics, but for the most part, you know, all that stuff where you go, well, how do I get the most out of what I've got? And I reckon, like I always talk about my mum being a high performer because she's nearly died about 9 times and she just fucking goes, nah, just sticks the middle finger up to death. Hey, death, get fucked. Sandwich anyone? You know, but that's, for me, that's high performance is getting
absolutely.
The most out of, you know, so I think that'll be good. And so will you address the psychological, emotional, physiological?
Yep. All of that.
Will you open the door on the spiritual?
I'm mulling it over. I don't think so on the first one because I want to write a little series. So I think my second one, and it's probably going to be the 7 rituals of mental vitality, and then another one, the 7 rituals of resilience, or the 7 resilience rituals. When I get into the resilience stuff, I'm going to open the door on spirituality / purpose / meaning in life, because that's really important. But I think I'm going to write a shorter one first and then go a little bit bigger. But, you know, when it comes to publishers, it might be different.
I want you to come up with a question for the big fella, but before you do that, so how'd you go in your fight?
I won my first tournament.
Oh, you won the tournament.
Yeah, but it was development, right? So
and
it's kind of over 45's development. But I had my first tournament before I had my first class.
Oh, really? Really? How does that work?
Well, because I wanted to become a Kumite coach so that I could coach my kids. And I said to Sensei Peter, what do I need to do? And he said, well, you need to get a blue belt and then you do a weekend course. So I said, okay, I need to start coming to classes. And it was Thursday and I was driving home and I thought, well, fuck, if I'm going to start going to classes, I may as well compete.
Yeah.
There's a tournament on Sunday. So I phoned up Pete and I said, what do you think? And he said, well, look, you kind of know.
What had you done up until this point in
nothing.
Time?
I'd watched my kids, right? So
Hang on. So you're going into a tournament untrained. And you win.
Well, he said.
Does that mean you're a fucking freak or they're shit ass?
I think they're shit ass. So he said, go and have a PT with Dean, who's his son and sensei, and on Saturday morning. So I went and he taught me all the rules and a bit of this. And lent me gear, and I rocked up, and went all right.
Was it contact?
No. So that was it. Within 2 seconds, I got a warning because I punched somebody in the face.
Yeah,
because I'm not used to missing, right?
Yeah.
That was the thing. So I think I had 3 or 4 fights, and I ended up winning the tournament. And my Oscar, because he was really embarrassed that I was doing it, and then he was like, oh.
He's like,
oh, Dad, yeah, Dad, not be that bad.
Please don't do that.
But it's all buggers, right? So this year I'm in the elite, which is different. That's a different. These are guys who've done it for 10, 20 years.
Okay, right? So these are real martial artists.
I did one elite tournament at the end of last year, and there's only one other guy in it, and I knocked him out.
Really?
But he I reckon he faked it.
Really?
And I got disqualified. Yeah. I'll show you the video afterwards. Yeah. It's quite funny.
So, sorry for everyone else. No one's interested in this question, but I am. So, white belt, and then is it yellow?
Yeah, no, it's white, then red. So, I'm now white with red stripe.
Right.
So, I've done my grading, and then it goes, there's a whole heap of them, yellow, green.
How old do you reckon you'll be when you get your black?
It's probably 4 or 5 year process.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't just hand it out.
Well, they reckon in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, if you get it in 8, you're a freak almost, 10 years.
Yeah. Some of them, some of the disciplines are tougher than others.
Yeah.
But for me, the whole thing is about making memories with my kids.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, that's the sort of stuff that, you know, we'll remember for a lifetime if we can all be in the state team or, you know,
that'd be amazing.
Australia, Oceania, that sort of stuff.
Are you ready? You got a question?
I was just going to ask, you touched on a subject before we started recording to do with developmental stages. Mm-hmm. You were talking about men when they were approaching late teens and then again midlife, that sort of thing. I was just going to ask if you could maybe expand on that because it sounded quite interesting.
We were talking about the inverse correlation while he gets his notes out. We were talking about the inverse correlation between intelligence and testosterone production, I think, or maturity.
And look, the reason I know about this is I did a little bit of digging because I'm coaching a couple of young guys because I'm pretty passionate about the mental health, right?
Yeah.
And so I do some stuff with my local foodie club, with my team. We're at risk, 40-year-old men, and then teenage boys, right? Two big suicide groups. So I did some digging, came across this psychologist called Daniel Levinson, who talked about the transition periods of men. And the early transition period is teenagers. It's that sort of 16 to 18, 19 years where you're transitioning into the pre-adult world. So you're leaving the world of the child and moving into another world. And I really liked it because it synced in with some of the digging and I'd done around neuroscience. Like, we know at that age, there's a massive increase in dopaminergic neurons, right? Which is basically saying, leave the tribe. Because it's not good for the gene pool to have sex with your sister, right? So it's all about
a few other reasons,
exploration and that sort of stuff, right?
Hang on, ooh.
And so this ties in quite nicely where it's that separation from your parents. So you feel a little bit disconnected from them. So emotionally, but also spiritually and physically and financially, right? So it's that period. It's also about, what's my role in the world, right? Mm-hmm. That's the age when there's a huge amount of development of those frontal lobes, and it's saying basically,
well, what am I going to do? What am I going to be, right? And it's where you look at all primates or other mammals that teen males fuck off, right?
Yeah.
And an interesting one is where they don't have a lot of eye contact. Because in the primate world, eye contact's a sign of aggression. If I'm a teen male and you're the big silverback and I'm looking at you in the eye, you're going to rip my head off. So they tend to avert their eyes. And this is why teenagers often, people say they seem very withdrawn and they don't engage, eye contact, that sort of stuff. So there's a lots of stuff behind it. But basically, it's really about then you start to develop this dream about, he calls it the dream about where I am in the world, and we have this narrative, and all blokes that I've talked to have gone, fuck yes, I have it. And I'm not sure whether females have, but it's basically where you have this story in your head where you are the central character, where you're the hero in the story, right? Where you're going to go and do great things in the world, and he calls it the dream, and that's where you're working out what your dream is, right? And it's that period where you're leaving old friends, you're starting to leave your parents, you're kind of dipping your toe a little bit into this, that, and the other thing. And I find some of the young guys, they feel this pressure to just go and do stuff. And I'm like, dude, take your fucking time, right? This is an era for exploration, right? Most males, from this guy's research, take about 15 years to fully emerge from it, right?
Yeah.
So it's just like, don't be in a hurry, right? That's the age to go out. And, you know, enjoy your youth in a responsible way, but test a little bit of this, test a little bit of that, test a little bit of the other thing, right? Go and do some. So what I've done with these guys is getting them to go and do, jump onto Martin Seligman's stuff around your strengths finder. Do that, and then we'll sit down and map that across and say, okay, so where do you think those strengths, where do you think you might want to get a job where those strengths could actually play on a daily basis, right? And it's just having that little guide by the side, because what teenage boys need is they need a mentor, right? That's not their father, right? That's the really key thing. And that's what they used to have in those tribal societies that is missing today, right? Is having a male mentor who's not their father, who can actually help them on this journey. And lots of traditional societies have that, right? And then you look at the whole coming of age ceremonies, the Jewish bar mitzvah and all of these, and the shamans, they have one of those, you know, involving that frog poison with sapo and stuff like that. And that's missing in our society. And there's nobody to guide them. There's nobody to guide these guys and say, actually, this is what's happening, right? Here's what's happening in your brain. Here's what's happening in your consciousness right now, that your brain's going, fucking hell, wibble, where do I fit all of this sort of stuff? So let's go on a journey. Let me be the guide by your side, prod you a little bit, ask you some questions. You know, you can go away, bounce some stuff, come back, let's have another chat. So that's the stuff that I'm finding really quite interesting and I'm quite passionate about at the minute.
Wow. That's so interesting. Good question, Melissa.
It's fascinating.
And I reckon Pandora's one of the box. Things, I get asked this, or people share this with me a lot, like it's essentially, I don't know my purpose. I don't know what my purpose is, or my path, or my destiny, or my whatever, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And it's like people feel like they've got to figure it out by Tuesday.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, it's all good. Relax. I'm still not sure. And I'm 100. Exactly. And I've done a million things.
Yeah.
And I still, do I have absolute clarity, certainty about? No, I don't. I don't. But I've got some ideas. But it's, you know, I think that it, and your best, whatever trajectory or path or, you know, purpose will vary over time.
Absolutely.
Like it's not the same when you're 50 as when you were 30 or 20.
And this is what this psychologist talks about then, the midlife transition period, right? Which coincides with the midlife crisis. It's about that age 40 to 45, where it's about you're now going, okay, well, I should be responsible now. How the fuck's my dream stacking up with my reality?
Exactly. And right? All this shit should have happened.
Yeah.
It should have happened. It didn't. I'm a dud. Fucking, I waste, so many people have said to me, and I'm sure to you, and I've shared this, my life wasn't meant to turn out this. Right. wasn't my plan.
That's right. So that's what he calls the dream, right? Yeah. And so it's that in those early 40s, you're going, well, what's my skill set? What the fuck have I done, right? How am I comparing against where I wanted to be?
Yeah.
And then how useful am I? How useful am I to me and the people around me? And how useful am I to society?
Yeah. Right?
So having people understand that this is a normal psychological development that people go through, in this theory anyway, which seems to be reasonably valid. But the other thing I think for middle-aged guys is it coincides with andropause, right? Rather roughly, right? Yeah. Which for the listeners, I know you know what it is, but it's the male version of menopause where in your 40s, and it depends whether it's early or late, depending on who you are and how much fucking heavy shit you lift and stuff like that, right? But you get massive drop-offs in growth hormone, DHEA, and testosterone, right?
Your dick stops working, let's
be honest. Yeah, yeah. And your libido goes.
I've had an erection since the 90s. Fucking hell. Hope something happens soon. Might have to watch one of those videos.
Oh, God.
Is that bad? Did I overshare?
Yep.
Okay.
Just a touch. But it's interesting, right? Because you then... You have those reduction in those anabolic hormones means that basically your libido goes, your energy goes. You know, I'm fucking tired all the time now, right? Mm. And mentally, it starts to have an impact as well.
Yeah.
So you put that in with my life isn't stacking up with the dream, my dream, and this is a fucking perfect storm, I think.
Oh, there's another conversation there to be had around andropause and just the way that because what Paul's saying is 100% true. It is. It's essentially the boy version of menopause, and there's no generally accepted treatment for that. It's like, and fortunately, I think you're probably okay. I'm okay because I don't smoke, drink, do dumb shit.
And I lift heavy shit.
I lift heavy shit all the time. So, you know, it's okay, but I do think that, you know, for a lot of guys who perhaps don't have the lifestyle that you and I do, or, you know, that they hit whatever, 40, 45, 50, and everything just turns to shit. Mm. And with that decline in testosterone is cognitive impairment, is obviously no libido, is muscle loss, is decreased bone density, is depression, is or potentially all this anyway. And the answer, and generally the response is, well, mate, that's because you're 50. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Well, fuck, hang on. You know, like that's like going, well, I'm not producing any insulin. Oh, well, that's because you're diabetic. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Well, hang on.
You know what the crux of it is? And it's a conversation I had with Margie Smith, the molecular geneticist, who's a very sharp cookie. And she said it sort of half jokingly, but there's a truth behind it, that we all sign a pact with our genes when we're born, right? Mm. And that deal says, our genes say, I'll look after you, I'll keep you in shape, I'll keep you safe from disease. And we fail to read the small print. And the small print says, until you've passed optimal childbearing age, and then all bets are off.
Yeah.
Because your genes actually don't give a flying fuck about you. They are concerned with survival of the species.
Yes.
And you're just a vehicle for it.
Oh, fucking hell. That's terrifying.
But that's when lifestyle, you got to work harder, right? Yep. When you get to our age, you just got to work harder. It's a fact of life.
Message, fellas. Lift some shit. Get some sleep.
Don't eat shit food.
Don't eat shit food. Don't be too stressed, because stress fucks up your testosterone as well.
Yeah.
A little bit of meditation and...
social connection.
And also, you know what increases testosterone? This is not even a fucking joke. There's research on it. Driving fast, loud cars and motorbikes increases testosterone. But that does. It does.
Would do.
It's on Joe Rogan. Must be true. mate, thanks for chatting with us again.
Pleasure.
Oh, I love this job. What a great job. Just talking about stuff, interesting conversations, interesting explorations into the way we think and behave and choose and do and create on planet Us. This wouldn't happen without the support of my major sponsor, Max's and Maxine's. So thank you guys for providing great supplements to Australia for over 3 decades, and to me personally for a decade or so. My abs and I thank you. If you need to get in shape, if you want that part of that process to be well supplemented, then head to maxes.com.au or maxinesburn.com. That's kind of the ladies area. Maxes is more the dudes, but there's a bit of interchange there. So I know lots of girls who use Maxes products as well, either or both. Thanks for your support, Maxes, and thanks for being a part of this, everybody.